You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Max toku ingoa, no mai hari mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ra for Wednesday. I'm your host Max and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Manny. Efai Akine coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the government's initiatives aimed at moving young people out of benefit dependency. Associate Education Minister David Seymour's announcement of changes to how the government contracts school attendance services, and I also spoke to Ricardo about the Green Party interviewing the families of the three New Zealanders detained as part of the Sumud flotilla, along with Foreign Minister Winston Peters' action to blame the radical left for the vandalisation of his Auckland home. And I speak with Paul Talon, a senior lecturer from the Faculty of History, Arts and Education at the University of Auckland, to discuss the recent actions by US President Donald Trump to deploy the National Guard in democratic states and what this means for American democracy. Manny, what do you have for us today?
I speak to Associate Professor George Laking about the government's announced changes to bowel cancer screening. And I also speak to Craig Stephens, Professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland, on the recently released Our Environment 2025 report by the Ministry of the Environment.
He aho o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene korero anō, he pakihere roki mā runga i te pai, tuku o irirangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
The government announced two new initiatives aimed at moving young people out of benefit dependency and are looking to motivate them to stay in work by providing a $1,000 incentive if they are able to keep stable work for more than 12 months. In the same announcement, they stated that young adults aged 18 and 19 will no longer be eligible for job seeker payments if their parents can support them, for which they set the bar as an annual household income of just over $65,000. In addition to this, the Green Party conducted a public interview on Monday with the families of the three New Zealanders who were detained by Israel aboard the Sumud flotilla. The goal of the flotilla was to break through Israel's illegal blockade that has existed since 2007 and provide aid to those suffering in Gaza. As a result of rising tensions towards the government's stance on Gaza, Foreign Minister Winston Peters' Auckland home was vandalised on Tuesday, the day after the press conference where Chloe Swarbrick urged the government to act against Israel. Peters then blamed the vandalization where a protester broke his window and left a note saying, "Welcome to the real world," on what he described as the radical left. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, we speak to him about the vandalization of Foreign Minister Winston Peters' Auckland home, what the Green Party is asking of the government as the next step in Aotearoa's stance against Gaza, as well as the government's initiatives aimed at moving young adults towards independence. We also speak about Associate Education Minister David Seymour announcing a change to how the government contracts school attendance services.
To begin, what was the Green Party's reaction to the two new initiatives announced by the government?
Well, they're nothing short of BS. Let's make it clear, the so-called eligibility criteria that they've set means that if you're earning $67,000 as a household, so that's basically both parents earning more than around $67 combined, they won't be able to have their 18 and 19 year old accessing a benefit. You can't live on $66,000 as a household with a young adult. It's simply unfeasible. And the Prime Minister is blaming young people for an economic crisis and an unemployment crisis that they have manufactured by cutting thousands and thousands of jobs due to the cancellation of kāinga ora projects, cuts in the public sector, and using unemployment as a tool to lower inflation.
Minister for Social Development of New Zealand Louise Upston said that going on welfare when you're young is a trap. How do you respond to that framing?
What we are seeing in the news is young people applying for jobs in a way that actually makes it impossible for them to get them. We've got cases where you've got hundreds of applicants for the very same job. We've got a situation where we've got four job seeker beneficiaries for every job ad available. And I think to punch down on young people is just not feasible. And the reality is we've got a safety net to support people during these tough times. Pulling the rug at a time of high unemployment only leads to greater poverty. And when young people enter into deep poverty, we actually make it harder for them to enter into employment and education, the very same things the government talks about that they want young people to do.
You mentioned a safety net. Do you think that this policy risks leaving some people without that? And what consequences could that have?
So if you've got an 18 and 19-year-old who is unable to access a benefit while being unemployed and living already in a household that is struggling to make ends meet, what you're effectively doing is leaving them without the means to pay for things like rent, to be able to pay your bills, and pushing people into debt. Those consequences are long-term. You're effectively making it harder for someone to get back on their feet, enter education, enter employment. And the minister also needs to realize that if she is so serious about supporting young people into employment, that she should stop the closures that we are seeing of our vocational education courses and even campuses in some cases that will leave young people in rural areas without the means to enter vocational education in the regions that they live in.
The government is offering a $1,000 payment for young people who find a job and stay off the benefit for 12 months. Does a financial incentive like this make a difference in encouraging long-term employment for young adults?
Not when there are not enough jobs available. And we also got to get real, right? I mean, $1,000 is all well and fine. But when you think about that in the context of how much that is as a proportion of the total money someone makes, even in a minimum wage, it's not much. And so I think if the government wants to incentivize work, what they should be doing is creating decent jobs that offer good wages and good working conditions to ensure that we support people to enter education by making our tertiary education free and making sure that we support people who are having to do things like unpaid placements that put a huge burden on their ability to finish their courses, as opposed to these blunt tools that the government is introducing that will do nothing to actually incentivize people going into work when there are not enough jobs available.
And if the Green Party is to support initiatives to help young people into work and independence, what would that look like?
The Green Party is committed to putting a green jobs guarantee that will create tens of thousands of jobs in the construction and manufacturing sector. We've got a plan for that called our Green Industrial Strategy that people can check out. And we're also committed to ensuring that our safety net allows people to live above the poverty line to give them the tools and the means to meet their aspirations. We're also committed to supporting our vocational education institutes and your universities so that young people who are pursuing education can do so in a way that doesn't get them into debt and into hardship.
All right, moving on to the Associate Education Minister, David Seymour, announced a change to how the government contracts school attendance services to increase capacity to reach chronically absent students. What was the Green Party's reaction to this announcement by David Seymour?
It's all well and fine to have a fund to support people who may be struggling to connect with their schools, but I think what this misses out on is addressing the core drivers that may be leading people to not be attending school. So, for example, that's the unmet needs of neurodivergent and disabled learners who are currently facing a shortage of adequate support. It's also addressing issues like poverty, where you've got young people who are having to take up work in order to support their families. And so having someone who's just simply checking up on them want to address some of these more socioeconomic barriers that students face that means that they're not showing up to school or that they don't feel like school is a setting that actually reflects their needs and aspirations.
Do you think this approach tackles the root causes of why students aren't showing up to school?
Absolutely not, because in many cases, and even from my frontline experience before being an MP and working with people who may be transient homeless or who have dependents who are physically ill, for example, the reality is that issues like poverty, inequality, the unmet needs of disabled and neurodivergent students are some of the core drivers that may be leading to people feeling like school isn't simply a place of learning for them. And we've also got to address the reality that without adequately supporting our teachers and the staff that works at the school, we've got now more students per teacher, and that in and of itself also impacts the quality of the education system. And we know that teachers want to do their best, which is also why addressing teacher to student ratios and the conditions of teachers is essential to ensuring that kids feel like school is a place for them where they want to belong, where they want to learn and grow their skills.
The government's goal is for 80% of students to attend school more than 90% of the time by 2030. Does the Green Party share a similar vision for education, and what would the Green Party prioritise to reach these numbers?
Look, we absolutely support having a goal of people feeling like school is a place of belonging, where school is a place of developing your skills, but where we would be heading, rather than through initiatives like the one that David Seymour is putting forward, is addressing issues like poverty. And we've got a Ending Poverty Together plan that we put out last election. It's about ensuring that people have warm, safe, dry homes. And it is about investing in learning support initiatives that help meet the needs of disabled and neurodivergent students who are often being left behind by our education system.
Moving on to the last topic, on Monday, the Green Party conducted a public interview with the families of three New Zealanders detained as part of the Sumud flotilla headed to Gaza. During the interview, Chloe Swarbrick called on the government and Prime Minister Christopher Luxon to ensure their safe return and also move towards sanctions against Israel. Then yesterday, Foreign Minister Winston Peters' Auckland home was vandalised as part of a protest to the government's stance on Gaza. What was the Green Party's reaction to the vandalisation of Peters' home, and what did you make of his comments to blame what he described as the radical left?
Well, there's two things here, right? Is that Winston Peters is making assertions in relationship to the motives of the person who vandalised the home, where that information hasn't been yet confirmed. That is sitting with the police. So I think it's irresponsible to be trying to link those two issues together. What we've also seen yesterday in the House is New Zealand First making jokes and laughing about the crowbar incident at Winston Peters' home, and they can't have it both ways, where they're trying to both draw attention to the seriousness of a home being vandalised and then using that as a joke for political attacks. At the core of all of this, though, is the need to centre Palestinians who are experiencing a genocide, an ongoing genocide, and three New Zealanders, Rana, Youssef, and Samuel, have put their livelihoods at risk to deliver aid to Gaza and actually break through the illegal blockade that is preventing aid from saving the lives of countless of Palestinians. We're really stoked to see Rana, Youssef, and Samuel making their way back home safely, and we look forward to the next round of people going in a flotilla to try and deliver aid to break this illegal blockade.
Like you mentioned, since the Green Party interview, the Foreign Minister has announced that the three New Zealanders are expected to board a bus to Jordan today and then will be free to return home. What is the Green Party asking the government to do as the next step?
What the government should have done quite some time ago, to put sanctions on Israel as a consequence for the genocide that they are complicit in driving, to ensure that we start breaking those economic ties with Israel as well, as a way to putting pressure on Israel to stop this genocide. I mean, even for example, as we are seeing peace negotiations happen, Israel hasn't stopped the shelling and bombarding of Gaza, which is effectively continuing to kill countless of Palestinians. And so we've got to remember that despite all these peace negotiations happening, Israel has not agreed to stop the killing of Palestinians. And so our government has a duty and a responsibility to prevent genocide, a legal obligation even, that they are not fulfilling right now.
Chloe Swarbrick as well said that New Zealand has a legal obligation under international law to prevent genocide. Do you think New Zealand is failing in that obligation?
We are absolutely failing in our obligation to prevent a genocide. We're finding ourselves on the wrong side of history, and that is going to be a stain on our foreign policy record for a country that has often prided itself in taking bold, brave stands on the international stage to stand up for justice and for peace. And why this should matter to us is that the moment that countries like ours stop taking action to prevent a genocide, the more the world then becomes an unsafe place, because you're seeing less important players who do have influence in the diplomatic stage like our country does, despite being small, not being an active voice towards peace and justice. And if tensions were to rise up in our region, we would be in a much weaker position to demand the very same thing that Palestinians are asking for us because of our poor track record on this issue.
And just finally, how would you respond to critics who say sanctions could damage international relationships?
I don't think we should care much about the international relationships we have with Israel. I think what we are seeing, if anything, is the damaging of our reputation on the global stage when it comes to issues like the recognition of Palestinian statehood, like the lack of action that we have seen from our government to genuinely put in place measures to prevent a genocide. We've got plenty of trading partners we could be engaging with. Israel should not be one of those. And until they demonstrate that they are committed to not just ending a genocide, but to put in place reparations to basically return the land that they have stolen from Palestinians, I don't think our government should be giving Israel any of the good faith that our government currently is doing, both when it comes to trade, but also diplomacy.
That was Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March talking to us about the government's initiatives aimed at moving young people off the benefit, the vandalization of Winston Peters' Auckland home, the actions the government should take against Israel, and David Seymour announcing a change in the way the government contracts school attendance services.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
I don't kiss men.
The Wire.
But I kissed him.
In recent weeks, the Trump administration has moved to send federal troops into American cities, a decision many legal experts and political leaders argue is unconstitutional. Earlier this week, an Oregon judge blocked the Trump administration from sending National Guard troops into Portland, Oregon, ruling that the move overstepped presidential authority. The judge was originally appointed by President Trump, who now said the judge had lost their way. It's the latest pushback against federal forces being deployed into U.S. cities. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Karen Emugat was made on the basis that the president's actions were unconstitutional and that Trump did not have a valid reason for deploying the National Guard. Paul Talon is a Chicago, Illinois native and currently a senior lecturer in the Faculty of History, Arts and Education at the University of Auckland. I spoke to Paul to ask whether there had been any similar situations to this in American history and what the implications of these actions could mean for the future of American democracy.
Is this subtle aggression from a U.S. president similar to anything that's happened in the past?
No, I don't think it is similar to anything that has happened in the past. A number of U.S. presidents have federally mobilized the National Guard. This is not new, but there seems to me to be a big difference between what the current president is doing and what past presidents have done when it comes to the mobilization of the National Guard. Most recently and relevantly, there have been 5 mobilizations since the Second World War by U.S. presidents. All of these, though, have been in support of racial desegregation ordered by the Supreme Court and in protection of civil rights. For instance, the Little Rock, Arkansas crisis of 1957, in Oxford, Mississippi in 1962, twice in Alabama in 1963, and again in 1965. All of those were mobilizations of the National Guard over the objections of those state governors, but in support of racial desegregation and the protection of civil rights, which is a very different circumstance than what we see at the present moment.
Are these actions by President Trump legal, and can you explain why they are or are not?
The use of Federal Guard troops, let me walk that back and approach the question from this point of view. The issue is debated at this moment. We've had that Oregon Judge Karen Emugat ruling that the administration could not federalize the National Guard. She said, based on made-up complaints about crime. And this is the nub of the question. In the case of those interventions, that mobilizations I've described, there was a clear and compelling reason. In this instance, the current president is claiming that there is not a state of insurrection, but there are conditions of crime which local law enforcement authorities, so the president says, are not maintaining law and order. And on that ground, on that pretext, the current president is attempting to federalize
National Guard troops for deployment in Oregon, and has done so now in the state of Illinois. In the latter case, he has mobilized Texas National Guard troops with the blessing and cooperation of Texas Governor Greg Abbott and over the objections of Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. But the reasons the current president is claiming to mobilize these National Guard troops is that there is a state of crime and endangerment to U.S. citizens in Chicago, which simply doesn't exist, and which both the mayor of Chicago and the governor of Illinois have very clearly and strenuously said does not exist. Those governing figures have also said very clearly that local law enforcement is clearly capable and has been doing its job in terms of law enforcement. So that's, I mean, I could go on here, but there is more to the question here than meets the eye.
What are these ICE troops doing that is different to local law enforcement?
A little bit about ICE. So ICE, that is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was created as part of the Homeland Security Act of 2002 after the September 11th attacks. It is meant to conduct criminal investigations and to enforce immigration laws and preserve national security and protect public safety. So it works in conjunction with customs and border enforcement and with local law enforcement in that remit. What we have seen with the current president is the use of ICE to be deployed to cities such as Los Angeles and in Portland, Oregon, and many other places, including Chicago, to conduct raids and to apprehend alleged undocumented illegal immigrants whom the president has frequently characterized as violent criminals. And as we have seen, the president has deployed these ICE agents, again, over this strenuous and clear objection of local governing authorities like the mayor of Chicago and the governor of Illinois. In both instances, see, ICE is a federal law enforcement agency. National Guard troops are troops which are run or commanded by a federal military officer, but are under the jurisdiction of state governors and can be mobilized by state governors. In both cases, though, under the U.S. Constitution, law enforcement is meant to be conducted by, first and foremost, local law enforcement agencies and not by federal law enforcement, or at the very least in conjunction and in cooperation with federal law enforcement, and certainly not by federal troops or National Guard troops. That is not their training nor their constitutional purpose.
We've seen California State Governor Gavin Newsom sue President Trump for sending California Guards to Oregon. Do you think we'll start to see more democratically leaning states object Donald Trump's actions?
I hope so, because as both Newsom and Pritzker have said, and Pritzker has said most recently, the president's actions in the federal mobilization of Texas National Guard troops is unconstitutional. And what we see happening here at the moment is an escalating constitutional crisis. The moment of truth may come if the president chooses to invoke the Insurrection Act, which is reserved for extreme situations like rebellions or invasion. Neither of those conditions exist at the present anywhere in the United States. And in fact, what the president appears to be doing is operating on the pretext of law and order disorder to deploy ICE agents and federal troops and to create conditions of civil unrest, thereby creating the pretext for invocation of the Insurrection Act. It goes to what Judge Karen Immigrant said in the Oregon case, the made-up complaints about crime. And so, yes, the only recourse that state governors may have is to bring legal action. What's interesting, though, is at this time, it appears to be the federal court system and federal judges, some of whom are Trump appointees, many of whom are Republican appointees, who are continuing to uphold the rule of law. And that's the only thing standing between the current president going further at this time.
Do you think we'll continue to see these actions from Trump throughout the rest of his presidency?
Who knows what Trump is going to do? I honestly, I couldn't say with any certainty, but if his recent behavior and actions is any indication, he won't stop now and will only stop. He'll only bring when, you know, faced with decisions that do not go his way, as in the case of Judge Karen Emmergut.
And just finally, what are the long-term consequences to American democracy if federal troops continue to be used in this way?
In the short term, we could be seeing a scenario where we have the breakdown of the federal system of government in the United States, where we see the federal government under the hand of the executive branch and the military directly ruling American cities and states. That would be an amazing scenario were that to happen. Short of that, if that does not happen, already what has happened, though, has been a serious damage to the norms and principles that govern democratic government in the United States on the one hand, and a profound loss of confidence on the part of many citizens on democratic processes and government in that country. It's something that's simply unprecedented in our time and unimaginable to me as recently as a year ago.
That was senior lecturer Paul Talon from the Faculty of History, Arts and Education at the University of Auckland on why he hopes states continue to object to Trump and why we should never be sure about what President Trump plans to do next. We'll be right back after this short break.
To me, I'm talking it, walking it. My stop is out, will stop your movement. Hold up, who's this? Still living with cuts and bruises, so cut the bullshit before I rock your face with a pool stick. Dirty, don't rate it, front line. Free money, scribe, savage, and cross eye. Everybody gets feeling that shit. I'm out just speakers like ill semantics. On stage for the crowd reaction. Everyone just bowed your asses. Keep it moving. Uh-huh, New Zealand music. South Auckland, raise your arms. Let me see you go with us. And I will always represent my crew to step the scepter cause.
How many dudes you know roll like this? How many dudes you know flow like this? Not many, infinity. Not many, infinity. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this?
I don't know anybody.
Y'all know this is, act right. It's the kid coming up that's flow is untapped, rolled enough drafts, know enough raps off the head skill, little crush cats. But it's hard to spit without coming off arrogant. And y'all insist on dropping comparisons to y'all who sit mouths running and chattering. Get off my dick, you're so fucking embarrassing. Y'all don't want no part of this, upon this ish. I sort of ill like a pharmacist. I'm on to this, I've been broke like promises. So if you get me started, kids, you're gonna see the consequence. And y'all don't want that. Cause I stay on, give me your words to play on. And I'ma make your written look thick like you lost a pen and wrote a crayon. But yo, y'all should play the back like scenery. I'm dope. The writing's on the wall like graffiti. So y'all can even hold your own. You get a manicure if you're going toe to toe. Suppose you know that I shoot tracks like kicks. Cause I'm clean when I lace mine. I break minds if I put a watch in a bum bag. That's the only scene where I waste time. Let's go.
How many dudes you know roll like this? How many dudes you know flow like this?
Not many. Remix. Infinity. Not many. Infinity.
How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. How many dudes you know roll like this? How many dudes you know flow like
congratulations.
This?
Congratulations,
not many.
Infinity,
not many. Infinity. How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this?
Yeah.
I don't know anybody.
Yo, scribe, see it, so give it up. I never put the mic down when I pick it up. I rip it up so dope this year. Everybody wanna hit a vibe. But y'all need to breathe because you're hicking up. We refuse to leave, you can't get rid of us. Yo, they think I'm on drugs because I come in the club. And I be dancing by myself like I don't give a fuck. What? Scribe on the mic, I write an elegant flow. Even drop a Dazio for the lyrically slow. Not hypothetically, physically letting you know. I got my rhyme packed tight and I'm ready to go. Made some mistakes in the past, that was yesterday. Today I'm on my way to a better way. Forever bringing together what you separate. So whether you like it or not, I'ma elevate. You know this rhyme has been taking time to celebrate. Relax and take a breath, yo. I'm here to stay and I'll go. Going away, can I get a yes, yo? Yes, yes, yo!
Yeah, check it out. Yeah. Check it out. Check it out.
Can't know it like me.
Like me.
How
many dudes you know roll like this? How many dudes you know flow like this?
Not many, if any, not many, if any.
How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this? I don't know anybody. How many dudes you know roll like this? How many dudes you know flow like this?
Not many, if any, not many, if any.
How many dudes you know got the skills to go and rock a show like this?
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Sheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
So, which way is it?
The other's way.
Sorry, which direction?
Just go the other's way.
Okay, so left, right?
Other's way. You can't go wrong.
Left, right, front or back. Every direction is a good choice at the Others Way Festival. And your mates at 95BFM have tickets to give away. So stay tuned to Drive for your chance to win. Only if you have a B card though.
95BFM presents The Others Way, Saturday, November 29th. Tickets available now from Moshtix.
Mixtape was sad. She saw shows with specific themes and thought, who am I? Then one day she realised that she'd been lovingly crafted by her father Sam for a greater purpose, to guide people into their Sunday the right way. She would fulfil her mission, no matter the cost.
The Sunday Mixtape. Expect the latest drops, the deepest cuts, and everything in between. The Sunday Mixtape with your host Sam. Sundays 9 till 10 a.m. Right here on 95BFM.
Ah!
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Bowel cancer is one of the leading causes of death in Aotearoa, New Zealand, with over 1,200 people dying from the disease each year, making it second only to lung cancer. Free government screening is one of our key policies aimed at combating the disease. Earlier this year, the National Party's Minister for Health, Simeon Brown, announced changes to free bowel cancer screening eligibility. These included lowering the age of eligibility by just 2 years, from 60 to 58 years old, while scrapping a pilot scheme that gave Pacifica and Māori earlier access from 50. These changes have sparked criticism about the inadequacy of the policy. I spoke to Associate Professor of Oncology, George Laking, about his views on these changes and whether we are doing enough to tackle bowel cancer.
To begin with, I want to give our listeners some background. So before these current reforms, what has been the state of bowel cancer screening?
So we've had a screening program with an age of entry to it, and that's been a great advance because it increases the detection rate of early bowel cancer that's still curable. So the screening program's a very desirable thing. And then we'd also had a move for earlier age of entry to screening for Māori and Pacific people. And that was based on evening up the performance of the bowel screening program so it would work better or offer the same performance across all ethnicities.
Right, so Māori and Pacifica people were dying at greater numbers at a younger age, is that correct?
Yeah. within Māori and Pacific populations, there was a general earlier age of onset of bowel cancer. The effect of restricting everyone to the same age of entry was that all demographics would achieve an increase in life expectancy, which is a really good thing. However, non-Māori, non-Pacific demographics would achieve extra increase in life expectancy. So, you know, we've got a 7-year gap in life expectancy for Māori compared to non-Māori. And if you have the same age of entry to a bowel screening program, that life expectancy gap actually gets wider. Everyone lives for longer, but non-Māori, non-Pacific live for even longer.
Right. Wow. Does that mean that non-Māori and non-Pacifica people were getting more affected by bowel cancer?
It doesn't necessarily mean that. So far as we can see, the rates of bowel cancer amongst Māori and Pacific people, in absolute terms, have historically been a little lower than the rates amongst Europeans. Within Māori-Pacific populations, bowel cancer tends to happen at a younger age. The overall rate of bowel cancer has been a bit lower. It is increasing over time, and it's been approaching European rates of bowel cancer.
Right. So let's jump into these changes. What are these reforms that have been proposed, and how do you feel about them?
So what's happened is the age of entry to bowel cancer screening for the whole population has been lowered by a couple of years, and they abolished that even younger age of entry for Māori and Pacific people. So they made it the same age of entry for all populations. So on the one hand, it's good that there's a lower age of entry to bowel cancer screening. But on the other hand, you know, as I was saying just before, it's less good. But paradoxically, the effect of this is to increase the gap in life expectancy between the populations. The other thing to bear in mind is, ideally, there wouldn't be this restriction at all. As an advanced, wealthy society, we're entirely capable of setting up a bowel screening program that doesn't put a restriction on based on age of entry, but can be based on just clinical decision-making. There is a real issue with the capacity to do bowel screening, especially colonoscopy. We don't have enough of a workforce to be able to screen, for argument's sake, every single person in the country. We just don't have the colonoscopy workforce for that, and it will take a few years to train up the colonoscopy workforce. But I do believe there's no reason in principle why we couldn't do this. We have a big colonoscopy workforce and have pretty much unrestricted entry to bowel cancer screening. You know, in Australia, starts at age 45, so a whole lot younger than in this country.
What's the age from these current reforms?
58, as I recall.
Right. We've seen reports of a growing number of cases amongst new demographics of people, younger women. What do you make of this? Is it panning out in the literature, or is this just things we're hearing about?
No, this is also in the literature, and this is a serious concern, and no one understands exactly why there appears to be growth in incidence of colon cancer at younger ages than there was in the past. And, of course, a lot of these stories are very distressing because it typically don't expect to see cancer in a younger person, so sometimes it hasn't been picked up until it's been too late to cure. So this is the thing, it's not well explained, and we need to get ahead of it. And, again, that's another reason for a lot of the age of entry to bowel cancer screening. What might be the reasons for colon cancer happening at younger ages? Keep coming back to something to do with our environment. The food that we eat is kind of concerned in the background about things like microplastics, which we know every human being carries, but we don't understand the full health significance of that so far.
How would one of our listeners know when to get screened? What would be the process for that to happen currently?
So the thing about screening is the way the screening program is set up, that's for people who don't have symptoms, so they wouldn't automatically have any particular suspicion about having bowel cancer, and they're contacted by mail. That's how the screening program works. But there is a time-honored pathway for diagnosis of cancer, is to have a symptom or a suspicion, for example, based on family history, and then going to see your family doctor or primary health care service and having a talk with them, and that can set the right test and train.
And finally, just before we finish off, what are some things that people can do to prevent their risk of bowel cancer?
So probably a plant-based diet would be pretty high on the list. There seems to be this association with meat, barbecued meat, processed meat, and I have to say it's quite a struggle to get this message accepted by the food industry. We've got a natural interest in selling these products, but there's all sorts of reasons why a plant-based diet is a very good idea, not only related to cancer, but just related to the health of the planet in general.
Right. Well, thank you very much, George Laking. Have a good one.
Thanks, Manuel. Thanks so much, everyone.
That was Associate Professor of Oncology George Laking talking about the government's changes to bowel cancer screening. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Fresh Kid Z, Fresh Kid C,
yes, sir.
Fresh Kid P, Fresh Kid T.
Oh yeah, we back.
Oh, and Zaphoon, by the way.
Yeah, Jones. Yeah. Chitty Bang, and we pretty much amazing.
Can we hear your new song, please?
I got you.
Hey, yo, I once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we can toast. So fresh, how we flow, everybody get the style
hey,
from
yo,
us.
I
once was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and the fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party.
Remember
I'm never
you
growing
was a
up
kid? Reminisce days of the innocence. Now it's Chitty Bang, Google me the images. Follow me, I'm the leader. And when I park cars, I don't pay for the meter. I remember I was younger as a kid, it was the best. I used to touch on all the pretty girls in recess. I'm at my peak, yes, I won't leave yet. Cereal style, cereal aisle, I need checks. I can make these rappers run like a hard drill. Rock band, show you how the guitar feel. And I can care less how y'all feel. I got a flow to make a bitch do a cartwheel. This is that good, just pump it and relax, bro. And you could get it free, don't worry about the tax, though. And Zap Fool, thank you for the crack. But I play it Ron Burgundy, I anchor on the track.
Hey,
like
yo, I
that
once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we get toast. So fresh, how we flow, everybody get the style
hey,
from
yo,
us.
I once was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and the fans going wild with us.
Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party. I'm never growing up.
Can I please get a little bit of knowledge? Somebody tell Roth that I don't love college. Cause the real world's kinda like real world, and it's drama, so you are Svetlana, and I'm just a rhyma, swimming in the water, trying to dodge the piranha, and fly to Bahamas, pretty little mama, chitty in the spot, where you at, Perlita, show me what you got. They say, why you rapping for the kids for? I say my clothes come fitted, the lint store. This summer you can catch me on a big tour. I'm hot grade, I think they need to quiz more. And let me get with you, don't let the kid hit you. I'm the photo album Valletta has, big picture. The rule is, the dude is, so up, so Chuck, I'm a cool
hey,
kid.
Hey yo, I once was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we get toast. So fresh, how we flow, everybody get this style
hey,
from
yo,
us. Was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and the fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party. I'm never growing up. Was a kid, all I had was a dream. More money, more problems, when I get it, I'ma pile it up. Now I'm dope, want the bread, we can toast. So fresh, how we flow, everybody get this style from us. Was a kid with the other little kids. Now I'm ripping up shows and the fans going wild with us. Tell mommy I'm sorry, this life is a party. I'm never growing up.
I was never a good kid. Had to sit on my hands, stay still, tie it down. I had to force myself,
force myself.
And then I was a good girl. I kept to myself, daydream, big smile. You go far, oh, you do so.
I'm
holding now, bad dreams, fake smiles, you've gone far gone.
suffocation. Still have to force yourself.
Scientists have finally found the clitoris.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. Once again, please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Almost 3 years ago, we entered a summer of devastating floods that have altered the landscape of our neighborhoods and the demands placed upon governments, both local and national. To track dangers of this sort, every 3 years, the Ministry of the Environment releases its report, Our Environment, which accumulates and analyzes the environmental monitoring done around the country to keep track of changes and preempt dangers. I speak to Craig Stevens, professor in the Department of Physics, on the report and its implications for all of us. Before we get into the implications of the report, could you give us an outline for what the Our Environment report is and how it is written?
Yeah, so it's a regular report that the Ministry for the Environment brings out every couple of years, and it's a summary of the most recent science around how the ocean and marine environment is going, but also how that has implications for coastal communities and, you know, wider societal impacts, and then looks a little bit to the future. So it's very much sort of a health card on how our moana is going.
Right, and let's jump into it. How is it going?
You know, I have to give the report credit. It is pretty upfront with some of the challenges that are coming at us from the ocean. And of course, this is primarily in terms of climate. And so our emissions are changing how the atmosphere works, and that's trapping heat in the planet, in the planetary system, more heat than was trapped, you know, before we were generating lots of fossil fuels. And the big challenge for us is that over 90% of that heat ends up in the ocean. And so nations or economies that are very much tied to the oceans really want to be paying attention to how those changes are coming. And so, you know, Aotearoa, New Zealand is a sequence of islands in the middle of the Southwest Pacific. So ocean changes are incredibly important for us. Saying that, there's multiple pathways with which those impacts can arrive and are arriving. And so some of that is around just direct heat in the ocean, and so people will have heard about marine heat waves. So that's a pulse of warm water that'll hang around for weeks to months and just make it really challenging for the ocean to operate how it normally operates. But then there are also impacts around, people would have heard of ocean acidification, that makes it difficult for certain kinds of marine life to operate and how they have in the past. But then that feeds through to impacts on fisheries. And so, you know, there are parts of our economy that rely heavily on being able to catch sustainable fish harvest. And so there's a whole range of impacts that come just from the sort of changing ocean. And probably the one that there's a lot of focus on is around sea level. And so sea level rise. And that gets very sort of global in the sense that melting of ice in Antarctica, but also warming of the oceans throughout the planet, has an impact on our shores, even though it's tens of thousands of kilometers away from where the sort of the problem is starting, if you like. And that sea level is set to rise by tens of centimeters over the coming 50 to 80 years. But you don't necessarily want to be caught up in just that fixed amount, because it's then tied into storms and storm surge and so event-based things. And then finally, on that note of storms, a warming ocean is more likely to generate tropical cyclones or certainly very very wet weather activity. And so that then has implications for how we live our lives on land. You know, if we're going to be hit with Gabrielle-sized events a couple of times a year, we're going to need to be much more resilient in our emergency response and our sort of operations around dealing with heavy inflow of water. So there's lots of challenges that are coming at us from the ocean. And, you know, the report doesn't necessarily have the answers, but just improving our awareness and our evidence base for seeing what where the pressure points are coming, I mean, that's hugely important.
Right. So very broad impacts from things like erosion to, you know, we might expect higher levels of insurance costs to fewer fish in our oceans when we go out fishing. A broad impact, you'd say, on the lives of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, two-thirds of the planet is ocean, and yeah. So impacts that come from this sort of collector of all this heat, they're going to come in lots of different ways. And you're absolutely right in that, you know, I've sort of talked about the environmental and the sort of direct of environment to economic impacts, but there'll be those broader impacts that will be, you know, through increased insurance, through increased rates, but also a changing international economy as our sort of trading partners in the global economy are also dealing with the challenges that come from climate. Be that, you know, maybe having to change how their economies work or what they produce, but also having to respond to weather-related impacts, which I think we're pretty certain will be coming from a much warmer ocean.
So obviously a report like this gives us a really useful and important insight into what problems might be coming down the line and how we might address them. What might be the gaps in this report that we might need to invest in understanding more in the future?
Yeah, and so, you know, I think the report does, they've worked really hard to synthesize the available bits of work and information, but we have a very fragmented sort of environmental sort of monitoring and forecasting system. It's, you know, it's done in little pockets that come and go. From a national perspective, we can take advantage of global tools, but, you know, we can't always rely on them. And we can't always be certain that they've got Aotearoa's best interests at heart. And so, you know, the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment has put out a number of reports just pointing out that we have arrived at a place where a lot of our sort of environmental evidence systems are very fragmented. And so, you know, the report points to how we might improve that to provide the best information in a cost-effective way, so to help us respond. But I will say, I feel like it paints a slightly rosy picture. You know, environmental monitoring has been it struggled to maintain consistent funding. I will say, in the most recent Endeavour funding announcements from MB, there are three or four new ocean projects or programs starting up, but really they're only for a few years. And the one thing we know about sort of climate challenges is that you need sort of long-term consistency, and so you'd be better off funding something for a modest amount for a long time than a big whack for a couple of years. So yeah, there are challenges, but this kind of report I think helps everyone understand more clearly why we should be valuing the Moana, our ocean. You know, we're an island nation sitting in the middle of it.
Awesome, Craig Stevens. Thank you very, very much.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. That was Craig Stevens, professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland, on the Our Environment report.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa o I korero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Paul Talon, a senior lecturer from the Faculty of History, Arts and Education at the University of Auckland, Associate Professor of Oncology at the University of Auckland, George Laking, and Craig Stevens, Professor in the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland. Neira hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning into the 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.